I'm happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Mirabai Starr. She's an author and translator. Her new books are St. Francis of Assisi and St. Teresa of Avila. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
So these are small books that are designed, I think, to be sort of carried around in your pocket and referred to, as opposed to reading it once and putting them away. And both of these saints are people who were incredibly passionate and fascinating human beings. Are these, how do I say this, are these like your favorite saints?
Boy, it would be hard to choose. It's funny because I'm Jewish by birth, although not from a non-religious family. I have a lifelong Buddhist meditation practice and a relationship with a Hindu guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and a Sufi connection. So basically everything except Christianity until kind of later along my spiritual path when I found myself a translator of the Spanish mystics, St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul, and Santa Teresa de Avila. And suddenly I'm just like madly in love with the Christian mystics and these Catholic saints who are kind of outside of my own religious arena, but maybe that's why I can connect with them so well, because I don't have a lot of the religious baggage that I think people who grow up in a certain tradition sometimes have to overcome to connect with what's really there at the roots of their own tradition. I come to it kind of fresh, and there's like an open door. So I love them all, and you're right. I mean, these little books are a collection of my favorite bits of wisdom from these mystics. So I collected these jewels in one little treasure chest, so you can, as you said, open them almost anywhere and find a nugget that would be probably just right for the moment. Plus I wrote my own personal reflections on some of the essential teachings in my own sort of poetic style. So it's a collection of their words and mine.
Now, your own kind of calling to a religious and spiritual life was very interesting. Could you describe that a little bit for us?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, I grew up in a non-religious Jewish family, and there are a gazillion of us in America especially, so people who might identify culturally as being Jewish but do not necessarily have a belief system, and that was my parents. My parents were very active social justice people. That's a big thread, of course, in Judaism is social justice. So that was more their area, and they were very suspicious of organized religion of any kind. And we moved to Taos in 1972 when I was 11 years old. And in Taos at that time, this was a real gathering place, as you know, and many of your listeners know. Some of you were probably here too, because I'm sure Santa Fe also was. For many of the world's religious and spiritual traditions, especially Eastern traditions, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism. So I was exposed to kind of everything except Christianity, interestingly, when I was young. And when I was 14 years old, I moved on my own to the Lama Foundation. Of course, it wasn't far away, and Lama at that time was running the alternative school that my siblings and I went to here in Taos. And when I moved to Lama at 14, I really plunged into a deep spiritual practice, or many different practices from different traditions. And that kind of formed me. Lama, of course, is the place where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now, which is such an iconic book for many of us, well, mostly people who are older than I was, but for me as well. You know, that really introduced Eastern thought to a Western, particularly an American audience, in a kind of American vernacular, so that people could really relate to it. And so Lama was already kind of on the map as a pilgrimage place for many spiritual seekers by the time I got there. And so I was exposed to teachers and teachings from that were just of the highest caliber. Lama Foundation still exists, by the way, and it's still thriving as an interspiritual community, but that term interspiritual is only just beginning to catch up with the public at large, but But Lama has been about that business for 40-something years now, and that's what formed my spiritual consciousness. And really, until I was an adult, like well into my 20s, I thought everybody felt the way I did, which is that all paths lead to the same kind of ultimate reality and connect us with that common source of love, really love. But I have had a rude awakening and discovered that not everybody does feel like that. Not everybody is one of everything like me, and a lot of people feel like there is only one way.
And those people who feel there's only one way tend not to gravitate toward the mystical traditions of the kind that you're writing about, I think.
That is absolutely correct. So yes, people who feel that there's only one way do not read my books, I don't think, or the books of the mystics of any tradition, because you're so right. The mystics are the ones that claim that all is one because they've experienced that unitive consciousness themselves. It's not theoretical. It's not a matter of consulting a book about what's real and what's true. It's about going within, and it seems like the minute we truly go deeply within, it transcends all religious dogma and becomes deeply personal, but at the same time, absolutely universal. It's this paradox that the mystical path leads us to that oneness where we recognize our interconnectedness with everybody and everything, and at the same time, there's something very intimate about it.
Let's talk about these two saints, St. Francis being the patron saint of Santa Fe, among other things, but an Italian from Assisi. And I remember going to Assisi to see the St. Francis Church when I was a college student and traveling in Italy. And he was somebody who came from a very wealthy family and was supposed to go into the family business. What happened?
Right. So Francis was a medieval Italian man, as you say, and he was groomed. He came from wealth and privilege, absolutely. Groomed for the family business. His father was a textile merchant specializing in silks and very fine fabrics. And Francis, as a young man, was a wild teenager who loved to party. Interestingly enough, Teresa of Avila also was that way. She was kind of a wild one. And Francis was conscripted to the war. There was a civil war with Perugia. And if you were there, you know. When I was there, it was like Perugia's 20 minutes by train from Assisi, and yet they were at war with each other. So at that time, you know, it was like another world. But geographically, they're actually quite close. So in that war, Francis was captured as a prisoner of war, and he was in prison for a year. And anyone who muses on this, or perhaps, unfortunately, has experienced incarceration or captivity of some kind, can just imagine how dark that must have been. Whether he came from wealth and privilege or not, in prison, everybody's kind of reduced to the lowest common denominator. And I really gather from all my research and sitting deeply with this great being, Francis of Assisi, that he suffered tremendously in prison and went through a kind of dark night of the soul, to borrow from my other favorite mystic, St. John of the Cross. And in being freed from prison, his father was finally able to ransom him after a year. He was transformed, and that old, wild young man who was all about wine, women, and song, or sex, drugs, and rock and roll, to use a contemporary image, had become deeply quiet. He became very ill also, so he had a kind of transformational, probably life-threatening illness. And after that, he just became extremely soft and vulnerable. And one day he was out riding on his horse, and he encountered a leper. And of course, leprosy was fairly common in the Middle Ages. And so lepers were required to ring a bell to let healthy people know when they were coming in the vicinity of this highly contagious disease. But Francis came into a forest clearing, and the leper didn't have a chance to ring his bell before Francis had appeared right in front of him. And it was winter time, and the man was shivering. He was wearing rags. And when Francis saw him, he just, even though he had historically an extreme revulsion to leprosy, repulsion, he got off his horse, and he took his cloak, and he wrapped it around the body of this leper, of this man who was suffering. And he embraced him, and he kissed his face, which was covered with sores. And completely in that moment, any sense of separation and repulsion was gone, and he just identified with this man and with the suffering of humanity, which was the suffering in his own being. There was no difference between himself and the other. And suddenly the teachings of Christ that he had been exposed to as a Catholic became very, very real. And he, very soon after that, had a vision where Christ appeared in a run-down, broken-down church and told him to rebuild his church. And there's some debate in the literature about whether the message there was rebuild this particular stone church of San Damiano, and you probably went there when you were on your Assisi trip, or whether to reform the entire Catholic Church, which had fallen into total corruption during the Middle Ages. And in any case, he did both. You know, he restored the stone church. He left everything behind. He rejected the privilege and wealth of his family and lived among the poor his entire life and served them. Rebuilt this little church first, but really reformed the entire Christian church and returned it to these values of voluntary simplicity. Well, at least he tried. I mean, the Franciscan order became the largest order of monastic order of the church. And actually, during Francis's lifetime, it spiraled out of his control and became yet another institution, which totally broke his heart. I mean, it went from like a band of brothers that called themselves the Poor Little Ones to this enormous organization that had strayed very far from Francis's commitment to poverty and simplicity and identification with the poor. So he died actually very broken and betrayed. People don't know that. They think of this happy saint, you know, holding out his arms for the birds to land. You know, and that was
right.
Very real too, his connection with nature and creation. But he also really suffered, as many of us do.
It's funny how, and one gets this very much from reading these two books, the St. Teresa of Avila and the St. Francis of Assisi, these people who we call saints or the church calls saints didn't see themselves as saints and didn't live particularly saintly lives all the time. They suffered and, you know, in their own view, sinned and all kinds of things.
Exactly. That's what makes them so accessible to the rest of us. And what I've really tried to do in these two little books is make it about us. And rather than elevate these beings to this rarefied status that we couldn't ever hope to emulate, how is it that we can identify with their deepest humanity and connect that with our own deepest humanity? Because you're absolutely right, Mary Charlotte. They all are quite open about how flawed they are, how deeply human, how vulnerable, how neurotic.
Right. We're talking to Mirabai Starr. One thing I find interesting about them, and again, you know, I spent a semester in Italy when I was 19 years old and went around to different towns and was a student, and we were all studying art history and so on, and you see more images of the suffering Christ than you could ever imagine existed on the planet. And I think for many of us, they're a little hard to relate to. And one of the things that was so striking is that both St. Teresa of Avila and St. Francis of Assisi found tremendous connection in the suffering of Christ.
Exactly. Yes, they both had visions. I mean, that's the thing about mystics, particularly medieval mystics, is they're famous for having visions. You know, that's not something I've ever experienced. I've experienced that kind of deep quiet and meditation sometimes where my own sense of a separate self blessedly and momentarily dissolves into a larger reality. That's as close as I've ever gotten to a mystical experience. But these guys were having visions and voices and going into raptures and ecstasies left and right. And but one of the visions that they both had, Teresa of Avila and Francis of Assisi, was of Christ appearing to them in his suffering form, you know, his crucified self. And rather than seeing that as horrific and horrendous and frightening, what they experienced was this depth of compassion and unconditional love emanating from him, that somehow he represents for many people the brokenness and the beauty of the human condition, and this sense of what he was here to do and what we're each empowered to do by participation in this larger kind of spiritual reality is to help alleviate the suffering in this world, and not with some kind of white-knuckled response of, you know, I can do this, I can show up and I can stop, I can stick my finger in the dike and stop the world from flooding, or I can put out the fires by sheer force of will. It's more a sense of unconditional love that naturally fills the heart in response to the suffering of the world. Like, to shamelessly mix my metaphors for a minute, spiritually, Tara in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you know, the green Tara especially, is the embodiment of mercy and compassion, much like Mother Mary in the Christian tradition. And Tara in the Tibetan tradition was formed, it says, from a tear of the Buddha as he looked upon the suffering of the world and wept. And to me, that's that same kind of cosmic energy of compassion manifest in the world, inside of each of us, that's what we're supposed to do when we look at these kind of icons and images and archetypes of the suffering God or goddess, the broken-hearted divine, is to take the suffering of the world into our bodies and feel it, and from that place is a spontaneous impulse to love the world and heal it. I think both Teresa of Avila and Francis of Assisi had that experience from their visions of Christ.
Let's talk about St. Teresa of Avila. She was somebody, you paint such a vivid picture of this woman. I mean, she was gorgeous and voluptuous. She was a dancer. She was a poet. She was a musician. Not your typical picture of what you think of as a nun.
Mm-hmm. Some kind of pious. She was not exactly pious. Right. And yet she did become a deep contemplative, meaning she had a very strong inner life and a lot of stillness and silence that was part of that inner life. However, you're right, as a young woman, and really throughout her life, she was vivacious, she was very popular, very engaging, very charming, very beautiful, smart, and all of those things. And with those gifts, she was able to get away with a lot. I mean, she might easily have been excommunicated, if not actually executed, for her beliefs and her revolutionary reform efforts and all of these things that she did that were in violation of what you might think of as the rules, you know, of the institution of the church. And yet she was so engaging that even the inquisitors, because the Inquisition investigated her because of her visions and her activities, even the inquisitors fell in love with her and became essentially her disciples and sat at her feet rather than ruled her from on high, because how could anyone come into her sphere and not be taken with the power of her spirit, I think. So, in fact, I was taken with the power of her spirit in spite of myself, because I originally translated St. John of the Cross, and Teresa of Avila was really his mentor, John's mentor, and through him was led to her, and it was only because my publisher asked me to translate her after having translated Dark Night of the Soul that I reluctantly agreed to take a look, because I thought she was just a drama queen with all her visions and voices and raptures and ecstasies. And John of the Cross had this kind of deep quiet that I really respected. And I was trying to ignore her, but once I agreed to translate her, I was completely smitten, as everybody seems to be when they finally let her in. So even all 500 years later, she got me too. But she was just a very powerful personality who managed to bring everybody into her way of seeing things, and her reform of the Carmelite order was very much like Francis's 300 years earlier. She was trying to return the Carmelites to their original contemplative roots and a commitment to inner experience, unmediated through priests and rituals and the pomp and circumstance of the Catholic Church. I mean, she was saying, all you have to do, girls, because she was really speaking to her own nuns, she was the mother abbess, is all you have to do to be with God is to go within. And that was quite threatening to the big boys.
Right, exactly. It's interesting that she had a lot of health problems as well. It seems like there is, or maybe you can comment on, is there a connection between illness and kind of mystical vision?
Mm-hmm. There does seem to be, doesn't there? I mean, so many mystics we can think of suffered some kind of physical trials, like Hildegard of Bingen, the 11th century German now saint. Took them 1,000 years, but they canonized her a couple of years ago. Hildegard of Bingen, incredible woman. And she had terrible headaches, probably migraines. And all the saints I can think of, Julian of Norwich had a near-death experience in which she received these 16 visions of Christ that she called the showings. Francis, when he received the stigmata, Francis of Assisi, he was 44, and he was quite ill at that time with all kinds of diseases. In fact, he went blind at the end of his life. Teresa of Avila, her entire life, starting in her teens, had terrible fevers and rheumatoid arthritis, and she actually went into a coma at the age of 20 and was pronounced dead at one point. And in fact, they put wax on her eyelids and had dug her grave when her father, who was sitting at her bedside, thought he detected a slight fluttering in her chest. And in fact, she was alive, and when she awoke, she was paralyzed for a year and spent the rest of her life battling all kinds of physical illnesses. So St. John of the Cross was tortured in prison. He also was imprisoned by the mainstream Carmelites, and he suffered some kind of infection that recurred throughout his life until it killed him in his 40s. So yes, what is that connection between physical illness and suffering? I think many of your listeners are probably nodding your heads right now going, yeah, my physical challenges, my illnesses, my diagnoses have definitely been connected with a certain kind of spiritual awakening in my life. And I think for others of us, catastrophic losses, grief and loss, has been a real teacher and a catalyst for the awakening of a very deep, rich inner life. And we wouldn't wish this on anyone, what it took to get to that place. But it's kind of undeniable that great trials often lead to great gifts. And I think that's what these saints really represent, and that's what that suffering Christ image speaks to.
There's also a theme that you bring up in your books about these two saints of social activism, and as you said before, that's kind of where you came from in your own family, and there is, for both of them in different ways, a connection to not just contemplation and having mystical visions, but actually making the world a better place. What does that look like for each of these saints?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. Well, Teresa of Avila, toward the end of her life, she was ordered, and she had a vow of obedience, so she had to do it, by her confessor to write another book based on what she was describing to this man about the spiritual journey, the inner journey. And that night she went to her cell when he ordered her to write this book. She was in her 60s and she had been quite ill for so many years and was really exhausted from... She actually traveled all over the rugged countryside of Spain by donkey cart, founding monasteries and convents in her reformed Carmelite, discalced Carmelite order. So she was not up for writing another book, and she spoke to God as she before she went to bed that night and said, if I'm going to write another book, you're going to have to do it because I don't have the energy. And she received a vision that night of this beautiful, pure crystal. And she realized that that crystal is the soul and that it's the most beautiful object in all of creation. So beautiful, in fact, that God himself chooses to dwell at the center of this crystal palace, as it turns out. And she called this the interior castle. And she outlined her vision of seven kind of stages of the spiritual journey, which she called moradas. And around here in northern New Mexico, we know what the moradas are. They're the penitente structures where the hermanos do their secret mystical practices. But they're dark, often roundish, sort of organic spaces. So in Teresa's vision, these moradas were these round-like dwellings that take us inward rather than this kind of linear up and out of this world. It's this progressive moving inward to the center of our souls. And so the interesting thing is, at the end of that inner journey, after we've reached the innermost chamber, the seventh dwelling of the interior castle, and had union with the beloved, as she calls God, the only possible outcome of that encounter is to return to the world and offer ourselves unconditionally in service. And I think all the great mystics say the same thing. And Jewish mysticism, which is kind of my heritage, is saying the same thing, that the truest test of our spiritual connection, of our relationship with the divine, is how we treat one another. And in fact, the earth itself or herself, that is the truest reflection of our spiritual connection. You know, in Judaism, it says it doesn't matter. You can sin all you want against God, but when you mess up with another human being, you must make it right with them. And then you're making it right with the Holy One. So that's the thing that matters, is we are incarnated beings. And what is embodied spirituality? How do we act out this love?
And I think with St. Francis, there's such an opportunity to think about St. Francis in terms of the wildlife all around us and the earth itself.
That's right. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. You're absolutely right. That's the way to connect our spirituality, because for Francis, the Holy One is reflected in every blade of grass and every drop of rain. Is his beautiful canticle to the creatures is just a celebration of God in every form. He refers to all aspects of creation as brother and sister, from brother sun and sister moon to brother fire and sister death, and he praises them all.
Mirabai Starr is an author and translator. Her new books are St. Francis of Assisi, Brother of Creation, and St. Teresa of Avila, Passionate Mystic. She will be signing these books at the Ark Bookstore on Sunday, December 8th.
From 2 to 4 in the afternoon.
Right here in Santa Fe. I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a total delight. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.